This podcast is part of Hyperfunctional Ultra Healthy. The series features new commissions, films, workshops, and conversations, considering our individual and collective well-being by exploring societal and ecological issues that affect both people and planet. Commissioned and produced by Somerset House Studios. To explore more of the series, head to our website, somersethouse.org.uk. You can also keep up to date with the latest podcasts by Somerset House Studios by subscribing on your favourite podcast app.
My name is Timur Sitchin. I'm an artist based in New York. I have a practice mainly in sculpture and installation, and the core themes of my work are the environment and the role of spirituality in addressing climate change. I was born in Berlin in 1984, in West Berlin, and my mother married my father, who is an ethnic Mongolian Chinese person, and they met in Beijing when my mother was doing study abroad there in the 70s and 80s. At some point, they separated, and my mother remarried, and she married an Apache Native American in Arizona, and so when I was 8 years old, we moved to Arizona from Berlin. Heaven is Sick is an essay that I am still writing, actually, and I think I might be able to turn it into a book at some point. But primarily, it's, you know, kind of reflecting on my experience growing up in the American Southwest and my exposure to indigenous Native American culture, and also my contacts with Christian fundamentalist culture in the United States, and just reflecting on the profound differences in their relationship to nature, and then trying to really, you know, investigate why it is that those differences arose. My research led me to this idea that, you know, cultures are ultimately adaptive features of people, and they are in some sense reflections of the local environments in which that they were created or formed. And so if you think about the ultimate difference between, for example, indigenous people or Western culture, they have two different, you know, profoundly different evolutionary histories, and they, each of them kind of reflect the conditions that they were, in which they were forged. Yeah, so, you know, growing up in Arizona, you know, I was really struck by how, in some ways, you could really classify, or you could really describe the Western relationship to nature as almost a war on nature. And, you know, I always found that this was such a crazy contrast to the indigenous culture, in which, you know, nature is at the very heart of their spirituality and their whole being. And so, you know, going back and thinking about, you know, why those differences arose, it made me think about how, you know, you can regard culture as a kind of adaptation to local environmental conditions in which the cultures were evolved. As an overview, if you think about the differences between foraging cultures or hunter-gatherer cultures versus agricultural societies, or technically known as sedentary agrarian cultures, you know, they have kind of common features between one another within their categories. So, for example, you know, agricultural societies, you know, you have this idea of farming, and this led to this, to the idea of a private ownership of nature. Food surpluses led to class stratification. Domesticated animals likely led to gender stratification. And then at the center of their culture, they tended to have like a human-centered religion that, you know, in a sense, reified political power and the power over land. On the other hand, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies, the small group size meant that they tend to be more egalitarian. There's not large differences in power between members of the culture. Hunting and gathering meant that there tended to be a gender balance, more of a gender balance than in agricultural societies. And they tend to be, you know, ecologically aware. They know where, what their role is within a given ecosystem. And then that is reflected usually in their religions and in their spiritualities, which you know, usually have nature at the core. And usually also this idea of reciprocity with nature, that nature gives to you, to the people, but the people must also in return provide for nature. Our health is intimately tied to the health of the natural world. You know, that I think that that's a feature of indigenous culture that the West is really only now being confronted with in a very serious way. With climate change and with, you know, corona, for example, we're realizing, you know, that down to a molecular level that the health of our bodies are really connected to the health of ecosystems. You know, for example, with zoonotic viruses, you know, people used to think that, you know, the viruses just kind of existed in animal populations in the wild, and then it was just kind of chance contact that would, you know, lead to contagion in humans. But they're realizing now, only in the last, you know, decade or so, that actually the very conditions for the productions of viruses are dependent on the health of the ecosystems. And, you know, if you think about it, it's not very far-fetched, because, you know, if you're stressing animal bodies, you're stressing their immune systems and et cetera. But, you know, this kind of subtle way in which our health is tied to the health of nature is really also something that, you know, indigenous people have been warning the rest of the world for centuries now. From this idea that of culture being an adaptive feature of societies, specifically if you think about religions, you can think of religions as adaptive technologies in themselves. So in a sense, they're kind of protocols for adaptive behavior for local environments. And what they do is they're powerful meaning systems, and they can influence human behavior in a very powerful way. But also there's this evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson, who writes about religion, and he describes religions as primarily for people to achieve together what they cannot achieve alone. And so it's specifically at the group scale that religions have evolved. And, you know, what they do is they, you know, align goals and values and beliefs and norms. They, you know, confer legitimacy and authority, and they also, you know, provide supportive networks for individuals. For example, the revolution of Christianity, they probably provided the familial supportive network of Judaism to non-Jews for the first time. But all of this is also, you know, the way that they function is that they harness spiritual emotions as well. But the thing is, if you think about religion as a kind of technology, you realize that that they're, you know, they're technologies for specific local environments, but then when you translate them to other environments or other times, they might have, you know, features to them that are no longer adaptive anymore. So specifically in the West, in Abrahamic religions, what evolved was a certain bias against the material world, against matter itself. You know, this was, in some sense, this was like a synthesis between Judaic culture and Greek culture. So, you know, for example, in Greek, ancient Greek philosophy, you already had an independent kind of notion of an anti-materialism, in a sense, where there was the Platonic ideal versus the imperfect reality. Those things kind of synthesized at some point, and they sort of led to what I would call the anthropo-dualisms at the core of Western culture, you know, which are like nature versus culture, biology versus technology, mind versus body, matter versus spirit or consciousness, or subject versus object. It also, you know, later on led to this idea of the metaphor of nature as a machine, you know, where nature is just this dead object, in a sense, or soulless object, and that, you know, you can do whatever you want with it. You can dissect it, or you can kill it, as long as it's not, you can't convert it, and then and then it doesn't count as being alive. You know, today this is, you know, this kind of anti-materialism is like baked so deeply into our language and culture. You know, the term materialism is usually a pejorative in the vernacular. And I think that, you know, it goes back to this Christian idea of being in the world, but not of the world. But of course, you know, today we're running into a big problem, which is that climate change is a material problem, and we need to deal with it in a material way. But I don't think it's a surprise that people don't believe the science to it, because they're just not conditioned to think of nature as being an agent, in a sense. You know, I feel like it's sort of the West that is now finally catching up to what indigenous people have already known. And, you know, indigenous people, they, at the core of their spiritualities, they, you know, they recognize the world as being composed out of relatives, you know, rather than resources. Non-dualism is an important narrative that I think that my work is trying to popularize in some ways. You know, the idea of symbiosis is an aspect of evolutionary science that has only in the last several decades been recognized as an important mechanism in evolution. So, you know, especially through the work of Lynn Margulis, who kind of demonstrated that, you know, as opposed to the idea of the selfish gene or the, you know, survival of the fittest, nature read in tooth and claw metaphor of evolution, she demonstrated, you know, that actually it was cooperation that was at the core of evolutionary changes. You know, that in symbiosis in a way encapsulates this indigenous relationship to the world, recognizing that it's a matter of cooperation with the non-human world that is fundamental to a healthy planet. So I think that it's important today to try to articulate narratives of symbiosis. And I think that spirituality can be thought of in those terms. So New Peace is my long-term sort of meta project in my artwork. You know, for many years I was interested in the idea of branding as a kind of sculpture, or as a kind of vehicle or a bucket of ideas that you can kind of keep tinkering with over time. And then at some point, I realized that what I wanted to express with this material really was, were these ideas of symbiotic spirituality. And so New Peace was kind of born out of thinking that, you know, in order to affect human behavior, we have to kind of burrow down into these deeper layers of human programming, which are, you know, affected, I think, most effectively by spirituality and religion. New Peace is my way of articulating a new materialist spirituality, I think it's kind of neo-pantheism, you know, that tries to reject the old dualisms. And the strategy that I'm using is to use media and branding as tools of cognitive access. And the reason I do that is because I'm also operating from a what I would call a materialist model of the animal. Trying to clue in to emotions of spirituality and in order to ultimately address, make a mimetic machine that addresses climate change in some way. Yeah, new piece. so basically all of my artworks and installations are sort of branded under the new piece oeuvre. The result is that, you know, when somebody encounters my work, they see this narrative over and over again. And I think that there's a special sort of quality to that. And I think that that helps ultimately to sort of articulate and express the fundamental ideas that are contained within. I think about it in terms of there's these four sort of concepts that I see as potential contemporary sources of spirituality. So, you know, there's four of them. The first one I call undivided ground. And that's basically, you know, this idea of immanence, the non-dual, that, you know, we're living in this sort of mysterious ontological whole, which, you know, in itself rejects the dualisms that I was talking about. The second one I'm calling faith in pattern. You know, I think that faith is a really important or interesting thing to try and rescue from religion. Really, you know, it's a way of letting us act without information. And so faith in pattern comes, you know, also from this observation that patterning is, you know, suffuses the entire universe, that you know, from the smallest grain of sand to the largest galaxy, there's this innate patterning behavior that we can be witness to in reality. And this patterning tends to be very, very beautiful as well. And so, you know, in a way, we're like part of these grand aesthetic patterns, emergent patterns. And that for myself has always been a sort of reassuring notion that, you know, no matter what happens, that I am, or my life is, or any of our, all of our lives are part of this patterning. And, you know, this can get really technical as well. You know, if you look at nonlinear dynamics or chaos theory, you know, there's sort of mathematical and empirical evidence for all of these things, emergent patterning and self-organizing behavior. And then the third one I'm calling prey to scale, which is, you know, recognizing that it's inherent to scale itself is a sort of reservoir of spiritual emotionality that, you know, if you think about large scales, if you look out over a large landscape or look at mountains or you look at the night sky and you think about the time, the billions of years it takes for the light of the stars to reach your eyes, you know, all of those tremendous scales, I think, provide a sort of innate sense of spirituality to anybody. You know, I'm really just trying to sort of point that out and show that, you know, we all have access to spirituality in some ways. And the final sort of concept or observation for new pieces, what I'm calling purpose from difference. And purpose from difference is, you know, recognizing that it looks as if the universe is fundamentally progressively differentiating through time. So, you know, we started with a lot of hydrogen or helium, potentially, and then over billions of years and eons, you know, that material has progressively differentiated into, you know, all of the variation and variety that we see today. And so, you know, it led me to this conclusion that, you know, perhaps it's difference and variety itself that is, in a way, the purpose of life and the universe. And I think that you know, in a way could potentially provide a basis for a post-human ethics of diversity, you know, a post-human ethics that doesn't just rely on the human as the measure of all things. Early in my work, I was, you know, really interested in advertisement images and commercial aesthetics, and I was approaching them, I would say, as a kind of alien anthropology or an ethnography of global culture. I think it kind of had to do with my multicultural background, because I noticed that there were certain, you know, ubiquitous patterns that you would see cross-culturally between different cultures. So between American culture or European or Chinese, for example, there are certain images that you would see over and over again. And, you know, that led me to think that, you know, these were then potentially species-specific features of our cognition that were being reflected in these images. You know, at the time when I started investigating this, I didn't realize that really the images of the vernacular commercial culture of the West are, in a way, a taboo, an aesthetic taboo when translated into the art world. The reaction to this work was often to think that it was a sort of mimetic critique, or operating from a mode of mimetic critique in which, you know, the signs or signifiers of capital are sort of dialed up to a point where that it reveals their inner contradictions. That is a mode of art making that has a tradition to it, but that's not what I was doing. I was much more interested in, like I said, like a sort of ethnography of culture, and really thinking about these sorts of images or technologies as the extended phenotype of Homo sapiens. And, you know, for me, I always thought that there is value and, you know, ultimately political value in trying to understand these dynamics. So in a way, you can think of art as a contemporary secular religion today. You know, we in the art world, we engage in rituals already, for example, openings and art exhibitions. We already have, you know, our places of worship, our cathedrals, which are museums. And also, you know, another thing that contemporary art is doing is today is that it's defining a moral community as well. You know, in a way, we're kind of synchronizing our morality through these discussions, especially in recent years. And this is, you know, another feature of religions. Also, at its best, contemporary art, you know, celebrates difference and diversity, and also, you know, creates spiritual value. I feel like, in a way, you can think of contemporary art as sort of filling the role of a religion in contemporary secular society today. But also, I think that, you know, it could be a progenitor for spirituality in the future. Yeah. So I guess, you know, ultimately, what I think is necessary is for people to form a spiritual relationship to the natural world, you know, to recognize it as something sacred and to, you know, celebrate that. I think, you know, in Western culture, we've been led to this point where, you know, where we're very reticent of being genuine about the things that we care about. So, you know, even in the art world, the kind of the dominant mode of art making is sort of hidden behind a layer of irony that, you know, doesn't allow us to kind of genuinely express our sentiment for nature. I think, you know, one of the tools for that is the psychedelic experience. This is an indigenous technology that's thousands of years old, and the effect usually is, you know, a greening of politics, or, you know, recognizing that nature is alive in a way that you only abstractly understood before you had the experience.